My next guest, sitting opposite me in the studio, is guaranteed to generate a huge amount of correspondence even before he opens his mouth. There have been calls for him to have his visa to enter Australia revoked and for his talk at the Parliament of New South Wales and the University of Sydney, talks plural, to be cancelled. Well, given that he's here, these calls have not been heeded and he has been let into the country. And here at Late Night Live, we like to hear a range of views. But there's no doubt that any story we do that mentions Israel or Palestine will generate complaints from all sides. My guest is Richard Falk, the Albert G. Milbank Professor of International Law, Emeritus from Princeton University. He was the UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in Palestine from 2008 to 2014. And despite his retirement from that lofty position, he's back in Australia talking about his hopes for peace between Israel and Palestine. Welcome back, Richard.
Thank you so much.
I should make the point that you're one of the very few guests I have that's older than I am.
Well, I wish that was not my only qualification for being your guest, but...
Okay, you've visited Australia regularly for some time, but have you ever had a chillier reception?
I suppose not. The last time I was here, I also did speak about several issues, but one of them was Israel-Palestine, and I think there was some protest at that time also, but rather minimal and not carried on through the media, as this was as a result of an article in the Australian Jewish News.
I want to raise that article with you in a minute, but let me ask you this. Have you had similar receptions or unwilling receptions in other parts of the world?
Except for Israel itself, where I was detained while serving as the UN Special Rapporteur, there is a very pro-Zionist NGO called UN Watch that has tried to harass me in various ways over time, including trying to have me denied entry to the UK. So that's my only other experience.
Okay, I'm going to restate some of the issues raised by the Australian Jewish News in their article, Furore of Falk Visit. First of all, they claim you support conspiracy theories about 9/11.
Yes, that's always sort of used as a way of showing my supposed extreme and reckless views. My actual position is that the official version of 9/11 has some unanswered questions that the American people and indeed the world deserves to know. And for whatever reason, those questions that arouse skepticism have never been satisfactorily addressed.
Are you suggesting it might be a false flag operation?
Well, there are a lot of alternative versions of what actually happened, including the idea that the American establishment at the time knew something was going to happen and let it happen. What actually happened is something obscure. So I don't subscribe. You know, the accusation is false. I don't subscribe to any alternate conspiracy theory. All I do subscribe to is a skepticism about the official version. And I wrote the foreword to one of the early books that raised 17 questions about the official version. And it was written by a very distinguished philosopher of religion, actually, who happened also to be a friend of mine, and a very scrupulous scholar. So his questions, I think, justify an attitude of suspicion, but they don't vindicate an alternative version of what actually happened.
The furore of folk visit also says you blamed the U.S. and Israel for the Boston bombings.
Again, a lot of people were saying this, but they picked this out of context from my blog. And what I actually said was that when you have a foreign policy in an area that is subject to so much turmoil and extremism as the Middle East is, and you intervene in that process, you're bound to have some reverberations from sociopathic individuals living abroad. And the policy toward Israel is very provocative in among certain extremist groups, and therefore this kind of negative reverberation is something that you have to expect to follow from such a foreign policy.
Note, dear listener, that we will put up a link to both the article by Australian Jewish News and Richard's rebuttal on the website. So when we last spoke, you were not permitted into Israel. Have you been back in the last 5 years?
I've been invited back several times, but partly for logistical reasons and partly because I didn't want to repeat the experience of being put in what amounts to a prison by the Israelis, I decided not to go. I've given video clips of my presentations that were in the reason that I would have gone. But I haven't gone and...
Okay. What do you make of Jared Kushner's Prosperity for Peace plan?
I don't feel it has much political traction. I don't think it's a... It's not looking toward an agreement. It's looking toward Palestinian surrender politically, followed by some kind of economic... plan that will improve the daily lives of people in the region, or at least that is its promise. But the Palestinians have not struggled for their national rights for almost a century now to surrender for some kind of economic package.
Even if Jared describes it as the opportunity of the century, it's interesting. There were no Israelis or Palestinians at the launch in Bahrain, and of course the Palestinians boycotted the event.
Yes, I mean, it has very little appeal to people that understand the history and the nature of the tensions and the conflict. And the whole Trump approach since he became president, first appointing three extremists as the representatives of his presidency in the region, not only to Israel, but Kushner, Greenblatt, and Friedman are all extremists within the Zionist camp itself.
To which could now be added Bolton.
Yes, yes. No, what they did before this recent Bahrain meeting on the economic dimension of the Kushner plan was a series of one-sided steps. The movement of the American embassy to Jerusalem in violation of an international and UN consensus, the withdrawal of humanitarian assistance to UNRWA that was taking care of the refugees throughout the region, and the recognition of the annexation of the Golan Heights, all of these steps moved away from what prior American presidents had done, which was to lean toward the Israeli side, to be partisan. But what Trump is doing is trying to force this Palestinian surrender, political surrender. And so it's a shift from partisanship to belligerency as far as the Palestinians are concerned.
You must be watching the tensions between the US and Iran with great concern, as do we all. How do you see this playing out?
Well, I think it's everything in this Trump era is unpredictable, and anyone that tries to be too dogmatic about what's going to happen shouldn't be trusted, shouldn't be relied upon. I think it's a very dangerous confrontational policy. I think the bargain that underlies it is that the Gulf Arab states were so eager to confront Iran that they were willing to make peace with Israel and to sacrifice the Palestinian struggle. So from the Palestinian point of view, this is a very adverse development because their support from Arab neighbors has considerably diminished, and they're faced with an American administration that's pushing hard the Netanyahu line in Israel, plus a basically unsympathetic regional atmosphere with very few friends of the Palestinian people left in positions of authority.
And of course, Trump has this very strong connection to Saudi Arabia to
yes.
cloud his decision making.
See, one of the things that I think is very harmful to American foreign policy are these two special relationships, one with Israel, one with Saudi Arabia. And when they say special arrangements, what they really mean is unconditional support. And so whatever Israel does, whatever Saudi Arabia does, is not seen. Whatever they do that's wrongful, violations of international law and human rights, they just fall below the radar. But if Egypt or Turkey do things, that becomes a human rights outrage, particularly Turkey these days, because it's seen as kind of a friend of the Islamic movements.
My guest is Richard Falk, Albert G. Milbank Professor of International Law Emeritus from Princeton and former UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in Palestine from 2008 to 2014. Now, the USA is still seen as absolutely crucial in any peace deal to be brokered.
Yes. I think my own view is that the intergovernmental framework is not capable of producing a sustainable peace. That if you really are interested in peace between the Palestinians and Israelis, it has to be based on a spirit of equality, not on a structure of hierarchy. And all the efforts at producing a peace over the past couple of decades have been based on finding security for Israel, but not treating Palestinian needs in any equivalent manner. And my view is that leads to a ceasefire, not a peace.
If I can go back to the USA and Iran, might the North Korea playbook work if applied here?
Well, as I say, anything in the Trump era is unpredictable in terms both of what happens on the Korean Peninsula, but what broader effects that might have. It is true that if he has success in Korea, he might try the same thing with Iran. And that would make him a very strong presidential candidate in 2020. I don't think the American people, as confused and contradictory as they seem to be at the moment, want a real war with either North Korea or with Iran. So from a pragmatic political point of view, he's much better off being a peacekeeper or peacemaker than he is being a warmonger, but he has advisors like Bolton and Pompeo who are definitely inclined toward military confrontation.
I think we all agree that giving Obama the Nobel Peace Prize was a bit premature, but of course, from time to time, Trump tweets that he thinks he should be a recipient. What are the main reasons behind the USA's obsession with Iran? Does it go back to the hostage crisis way back in 79?
I think that's a very insightful way of putting the question. I do think the humiliation that the U.S. suffered at the hostage crisis left an unhealed wound. And in part, this excessive hostility to Iran, which poses no threat whatsoever to either U.S. or Israel, for that matter, is a lingering sense of frustration that the American government was unable to release the hostages except when Tehran decided it was time to let them go, which was after the Carter presidency, first day of Ronald Reagan's inauguration, which made people suspicious that there must have been some kind of arrangement between the Reagan people and the Iranian government.
Since you left your UN post, what has the new rapporteur, Michael Link, who I think is from Canada, what's he been saying about human rights in Israel?
More or less the same thing that I was saying. It's hard to confront the reality of the occupation without coming to these same conclusions if you respect the evidence. I used to say that if you are only 10% objective, you would come to the same conclusions I did. You didn't have to be balanced, because the Israeli itself admits to the expansion of the settlements, which are unlawful. It admits to the annexation of parts of the occupied territory, which contradicts the UN authority and the international consensus. It has claimed permanent sovereignty over a unified Jerusalem, which again is contrary to the international consensus. So Israel's own policies, which were in some ways embodied in this basic law that they adopted in 2018, which said only Jews have the right of self-determination within Israel. I mean, it more or less accepts the critique that Israel has become an apartheid state, which Israeli leaders themselves have said internally in Hebrew, but they get very angry when it's said outside the confines of Israel.
So do you believe that despite all the problems, all the difficulties, that the two-state solution is still the best option for peace?
Well, I think that in these situations, the people who are coexisting have to make the final judgment as to what is acceptable, how they can coexist together in a sustainable way of mutual respect. And that spirit of equality is what's been missing in the whole diplomatic process, because it's been geopolitically tilted toward Israel, and that means you're trying to negotiate a peace based on inequality. And that won't work, in my view. So it requires a real readjustment on the whole U.S.-Israel relationship and the sense of how you achieve peace in a situation of sustained conflict of this sort.
Richard, thank you for your time. Richard Falk, the Albert G. Milbank Professor of International Law, Emeritus from Princeton, UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in Palestine from 2008 to 2014. Richard is speaking at the New South Wales Parliament and at Sydney University over the next few days.